danger is stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day when you give in. Give in. Give in. Give in.
Hello and welcome to episode 210 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. From Alberta, Canada, I'm Michael Johansson, joined by Dustin Morrill.
And from Owings Mills, Maryland, I'm Andrew Brokus.
And from Melrose, Massachusetts, I am Nate Mavis.
And we are so excited to have you, Michael, back on the show. And Dustin, welcome for the first time.
Thanks.
I got to say, and I'm comfortable speaking for Nate here as well, it really was a great honor and tremendous fun getting to play against DeepStack last Wednesday. Thank you again for affording us that opportunity.
Oh, thank you for playing. It was great to have you on again. I can't think of anyone else we'd rather have on for the first match.
You're so kind.
And that's very
I owe you guys an apology. When I watched the replay and my audio did not sound good at all, I'm sorry about that. I don't know if there's anything I could have done about it, but I did not realize it was sounding that bad while we were doing that. I guess an apology to those of you who watched it as well. Other than that, how did you guys feel like the match went?
Oh, it was good. What was the score when we left off? It was 3-2, I think.
Right, yeah, we were down a game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, good start. It's in the right direction for us.
It seemed like we had some good. The questions that you guys were throwing us from the Twitch chat were good, and then I realized in the replay we could see some of the other questions that people were asking as well. I was really surprised. You know, I'm not accustomed to getting a lot of good comments on the internet, but it seemed like people really understood enough to ask good questions, and I was really pleasantly surprised with the quality of the Twitch chat.
Yeah, that worked really well. I think the people that showed up to watch that match. Where the people are really excited about the paper or about the bot. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of random people stopping by and more really knowledgeable people with good questions.
We're about to enter the strategy segment of the show. And before we do, I want to remind you of two things. The first is that if you've not yet had a chance to watch Nate and me play against DeepStack AI, you can catch a full replay of the match. And that is archived at twitch.com/DeepStackAI, which is also the place to go to watch any of the future matches that DeepStack AI plays. Nate and I have both written our reactions to the match and some of our takeaways from the match. Mine is at thinkingpoker.net. Nate's is at natemavis.com, and I'll have links to both of those in the show notes if you have trouble finding those exact posts. So we'll do our best to tell you the details of the couple hands that we're going to discuss with the folks from the University of Alberta, but obviously the best way to get a sense of how the match went is to watch it and or to read our replays. The second thing to remind you before we get into the strategy is that our strategy segments are sponsored by Tournament Poker Edge. And Tournament Poker Edge is the place to go to learn how to kick the butts of at least your human opponents in multi-table tournaments, as we'll discuss with Mike and Dustin on the show today. Computers have not yet learned how to play multiplayer tournaments particularly well, and so take advantage of the chance to crush while you still have it. Sign up at tournamentpokeredge.com for high level, low level, and everything in between tournament poker strategy. No matter your stakes, you'll find something useful to you at tournamentpokeredge.com. So I guess our plan for today will be, to some extent, to go over some of the more interesting hands and to get a sense. I mean, Nate and I have discussed these with each other. We've each blogged about them. I think in some cases we've talked about some of them on Twitter. Obviously, we talked about them while we were actually playing the hands, but all that has been from our perspective. And we've got the opportunity now. You guys have been able to crunch some numbers for us and tell us a little bit about what I guess both what DeepStack would have done in our shoes and also its entire range in a certain situation. Right? So this is one of the tricky things about poker is just trying to learn from experience. Like, even when you find out what your opponent's cards are, which often you don't even get that much information, but even when you find out what your opponent's cards are, you still don't necessarily know whether or not you made the right play. I mean, you can fold and find out your opponent was bluffing, and it still doesn't necessarily mean your fold was wrong, because it might have just been, you know, you found the 10% of times that that he would be bluffing here. But it, in the case of Deep Stack, you guys actually are capable of having it spit out, you know, this is my entire strategy in this situation.
Yeah, exactly. This is kind of the nice thing about having a bot that doesn't pay attention to timing tells and isn't changing hand to hand, is we can actually go and look exactly what it would do and answer these types of questions.
And this is an important concept about, well, I mean, I guess you guys aren't really claiming or expecting that you have exactly an equilibrium solution, but I mean that's kind of what it's going for, right? I mean that like DeepStack is doing its best to converge on an equilibrium solution for playing heads up no limit. Is that fair?
Yeah, exactly. That really is the motivation behind it. And kind of the motivation behind all of our work before this too. So for example, like when we had 2 years ago, last time I was on the show, when we had Cepheus. Cepheus was our bot that solved or approximately solved heads up limit hold'em. So that one we actually can claim and measure how close it is to perfect. And with that one, we have the tool on the website where you can go ask it what it would do in any spot. And that is just kind of truth about the game. And it's powerful because it means that even if you're playing against it, and even if you're using that website to look up what it would do in any spot, that knowledge still can't help you win. It might make you lose less, but it can't help you.
Yeah, this is the point that I wanted to make, because we got some questions, or at least I got some questions on my blog. I think some people were asking this in Twitch also, where they were saying, well, if DeepStack will never respond to sizing tells, like, can't you just, you know, raise big when you have strong hands and raise small when you have weaker hands or something like that? And I mean, it's true that it won't exploit you if you're doing that. It won't, you know, recognize, oh, he always has strong hands when he raises big, so I'll literally never call his big raises. But it should be playing in such a way that you don't gain any advantage from doing that. And in fact, you might still be harming yourself in some small way, even though it's not going to take maximum advantage of you.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, we were even joking a couple days ago that we could, even for DeepStack, you know, announce its range at every decision. And we were trying to figure out, you know, how much this would actually help or if it even hurt our opponents. Like, if it was all this unexpected information you don't normally get, you know, could someone actually make use of that, you know, as they're playing?
I think it would depend a lot on the situation. I mean, just kind of looking at this one hand that you guys have already sent us, the strategy for it was a hand where Nate was holding pocket queens and ended up, you know, betting and facing an all-in on a... let me sure I get this right. So facing an all-in bet on a 7-10-5-6 board. So the flop was 10-7-5 rainbow, and then the turn is a 6, and Nate bet with pocket queens and faced an all-in bet. And I mean, I'm Nate, I guess you can answer this better than I can, but this strikes me as a situation where just kind of seeing this data of DeepStack would do this 18% of the time with this hand, and we do this 87% of the time with that hand. It's not necessarily real intuitive to use when you just, like, you would need a little bit of time to crunch this. How useful do you feel like that information would have been to you to have in real time during that hand?
It would have been useful to know more about what DeepStack's range was going into the turn. I could guess that, but knowing more would have been useful. This would be very hard to use in real time because and this isn't making for the best radio here, but I'm looking at a spreadsheet with hundreds of rows in it, one row corresponding to each combination of cards, and it's telling me how often it would have taken that line with that combination of cards. And you know, so I see like 67.97% in one spot, and 36.13% in another spot. That's black eights for whatever it's worth. And yeah, so all these fractional probabilities of all these different hands, it would take some aggregation, whether that's with the help of some scripts or just, you know, intuitively just eyeballing it, in order to make it useful for me. I can look at the top of this list and see that there are a lot of hands that beat me, a lot of flush draws, a lot of other stuff too, but also a lot of hands that I beat. So, yeah, it'd be tough. It'd be tough to do much with it.
And the probability of winning against its range, like giving your private hand and looking at its entire range and just bring out all the possible future board cards and such. You know, so you could actually know, like, oh, I'm, you know, 62% to win from here on.
That's what I was wondering. When you have this total win percent here, it seemed to me like this was just saying, what is the chance that Deep Stack currently has the best hand, rather than what is the chance that it will have the best hand on the river. Am I misreading that?
Yeah, I actually just noticed that I messed up those numbers just a little, because I didn't realize the all-in was on the turn instead of on the river. So those win percentage numbers are showing with the river card, which, you know, of course wasn't seen when Nate made his call.
Okay.
So that changes a bit.
It turns out the 9 is a really bad, even though the flush doesn't come in, a 9 is really no bueno for me.
I don't see that. Because it has a lot of 8s in its range, but all those become straights, so...
Yeah, I was wondering about this, because this is saying that the queens is beat 85% of the time, and yet the deep stack would have called the all-in with the queens, which was not computing for me. So that makes sense, that this is taking into account the river card.
Yeah. Okay. So it's just the columns on the right, just the beats queen and lose to queen. Those are the only ones that are wrong.
Okay.
Everything else is correct. It's the percentage that it gets there and then makes the action.
Gotcha.
Yeah, so there's... Okay, so I feel better about this. There's a lot of... A lot of hands I beat here.
Yeah, this one was one of the ones that I think Nate and I most disagreed about, and turns out Nate was right, where I was saying I think this might have been a fold to the all-in on the turn.
That's right. It's possible that betting is wrong, but once I bet, there looks like there's no folding. So some of the likeliest hands here, 10-9 of diamonds, 10-9 of clubs, fives, these are all sets, 7-5, these are all two pairs. Sixes, hand ahead, 10-8. Anyway. Yeah, look, just look at it. There's a lot of hands I beat here. Tons of hands I beat.
So, Michael and Dustin, is this interesting for you at all to look at a chart like this? Is there anything interesting that you gleaned from this? Have you bothered to look at these prior to putting them together for us?
So, I looked at them when I was putting together most of the numbers, and it was definitely particularly knowing that the deep stack would actually call there all the time, that was kind of surprising to me. As far as the rest of the range goes, it's maybe a little harder for me to get a feeling for what the range really means in terms of how you play against deep stack. So I maybe pay attention more to the just the strategy, like how much does it call here, how much does it fold here, given the hand that it was dealt. But I guess one interesting thing is just to look at how wide the range is. Like, do you actually get to this spot with a large number of hands or just a few? And it's kind of surprising that I guess how many different hands that you have so much chance of getting to the same spot with, or deep stack does, rather.
Is one of the big takeaways for Nate and me, and it's not even that I wouldn't have expected this, but I guess it's still not something I'm actually accustomed to playing against a player that actually does this really well. It's a concept that we're repeatedly calling board coverage, and I think, you know, not everyone watching really understood what we meant by that, but I think what you're saying here is kind of making this point of there's so many different kinds of hands that it has when it gets to the spot, and that's what makes it so difficult to play against. I mean, to some extent, like, there's so many possible, even when you're on the flop and you're just talking about one card that could come on the turn, there's so many, you know, possibilities that could come on the turn that's kind of difficult to be perfectly balanced across all of them. But this is what a tough deep stacked No Limit Hold'em player looks like is, you know, there's no situation where, or very few situations, and they're all low frequency situations, where a given, you know, flop or turn or river is going to so strikingly either help or hurt that player's range that, you know, their range is either so strong that you can just fold almost everything to them, or their range is so weak that you can just kind of bet into them with abandon. You know, ideally, deep stack is playing in a way such that kind of no matter what the turn card is, it's capable of having very strong hands, very weak hands, and I guess to some extent stuff in the middle. And you know, even as early as preflop, it's in some sense, and again, we're getting into anthropomorphizing here, I think, to say this, but you know, it's kind of like considering as far out as like river situations it might end up in, and it's sort of taking those into account when it makes decisions about, you know, what kinds of hands it's going to call a re-raise with preflop or something like that.
And can I just jump in here to help our view, our listeners a little bit? So we're looking at the spreadsheet, which again you cannot see, but in this spot, 10-4 of spades. That's a hand that the computer will show up with 1.75% of the time, and it plays in this hand that way 33% of the time. 10 of diamonds, 8 of hearts. 30% of the time it plays that way with that hand for a total of about 1.5%, 10-7 of clubs, 20% and about 1%, and so on. And it's really, really something. And also if you scroll down this list, you see that it has some threes and some fours in it, presumably to help cover some of the straights. And it seems to choose its flush draw jams, jams in some of these ways. And obviously it's chosen hands to get to the turn with fours and fives and threes in them. And this is just really remarkable to me how many of the hands are mixed in this way and how well deep stack and how deep stack thinks it's important to, you know, keep those threes, fours and fives in its range coming to the turn, or threes and fours.
Another, I think, misunderstanding that we saw a decent amount of among commenters is when a strategy is going to be mixed. In other words, when it will sometimes do one thing with a hand and sometimes do another thing with a hand. And actually, I'm curious, Michael and Dustin, whether, I mean, do you guys kind of understand strategy in this like theoretical way, or do you just sort of let deep stack do the work? The stuff that I'm saying right now, is this, am I like telling you things that you already knew?
Yeah. So for sure, with DeepStack and with all of our earlier programs too, having a mixed strategy is kind of the default. Like it feels more unusual to find spots that are pure as opposed to spots that are mixed. Mm-hmm. So as far as like the depth that I understand it, like I definitely understand the importance of being mixed in the same way that I understand in rock paper scissors why it's important to be mixed, mm-hmm. right? You know that if you're only picking one action, then you're going to lose. And so the same thing here, of course, right? If you're only betting with strong hands, then you're easily exploitable. Mm. But as far as, you know, which percentages and why, yeah, that's DeepStack doing all the work on that.
Mm-hmm. And the point that I want to make for, that I think a lot of people tend to misunderstand, is when a strategy is mixed. For instance, when DeepStack says, because there are some hands with which it is not mixed. For instance, when it gets to this turn with top two pair, it goes all in with it every single time. It doesn't ever do anything other than go all in with top two pair. So there are some hands that where it does not mix up its play. It strictly prefers going all in with those hands. And then there are other hands where, already I'm slightly wrong about this. If it has top two pair without a flush draw, then it strictly goes all in on the turn. If it has a flush draw, it will sometimes call and sometimes go all in if it has top two pair and a flush draw. So in one case with top two pair, it strictly prefers going all in. In another case, it employs a mixed strategy of sometimes calling and sometimes going all in. And at least at equilibrium, which again, this is not going to be a perfect equilibrium strategy because you guys are probably still, 6 months away from solving this game?
I actually wouldn't be surprised if it's far from equilibrium.
Okay, so yeah, maybe I don't need to keep making that disclaimer. But so at equilibrium anyway, the only time a strategy is going to be mixed is if both of those plays have the same expected value. So this is something, and we can talk about this, that 8-5 offsuit all in preflop hand in a second. But you know, I think sometimes people have the idea that you might do something that is a play with a negative expected value or a losing play. You might sometimes do that at a small frequency, and it's kind of like what might be called an advertising play or a balancing play, where you would say, well, you know, I'm losing a little bit of money doing this, but I want my opponent to know that I'm capable of doing this, so that if I get into this situation with a strong hand later, you know, maybe that strong hand gets paid off. And you know, that actually is not a feature of equilibrium solutions. So an equilibrium solution is not ever going to involve making a negative EV play. When it mixes things up, it's because it believes that at equilibrium it has the same expected value whether it calls or goes all in with 10-9 of clubs, and so it can do both of those things at some frequency. But then there are other hands where it thinks, you know, going all in with 10-9 and no flush draw is strictly more profitable than doing anything else, and so it does that 100% of the time. So if you see it doing something a small percentage of the time, most likely, unless that number is like 1%, which we'll talk about that case in a second, most likely, if you see it, you're doing something two different percentages of the time, it means that at equilibrium, there's not a difference in expected value on those two plays. And so when you're trying to look at whether it's a solution generated, I don't know if we'll be able to make any of these public, but you know, solutions generated by DeepStack, or if you're using some other sort of game theory solver, it's often most interesting to look at what are the hands that are doing something 100% of the time, because that's often the case where if you're not playing a hand that way, you're making a pretty big deviation from the equilibrium solution. Whereas if it's a hand that, you know, it's a mixed strategy between betting and calling, and you're strictly betting, you know, you may be exploitable in some way, but it's probably not as much of a mistake as if there's a hand that the equilibrium solution involves betting 100% of the time and you're not betting it. I think that's more likely to be a large mistake.
Yeah, I think I agree with you.
So there was one hand that really surprised me, and I kind of made a big deal of, because I was so, after being consistently outplayed by DeepStack in a few situations, I was excited to see it do something that I was pretty confident was a mistake. So the blinds were 200, 400. I raised to 1,200 holding Queen 10 offsuit, and DeepStack just went all in for 18,000. So first off, I was surprised that it would ever make that play. It's a quite large bet relative to the pot, and something I think we would only see very weak human players do. And you know, there have been some, like, I wouldn't be surprised if there are some things that DeepStack does that no top player right now is doing that turn out to be, you know, part of an equilibrium strategy. Like, I do think that's possible. So I didn't want to just say out of hand, well, there's no hand it could possibly play this way. But I, like, even before I saw its cards, I was thinking to myself, like, well, this is a really bizarre, I mean, it was a trivial fold for me with the Queen 10 offsuit, but I was thinking, you know, what could it possibly play this way? And I was even more surprised to see 8-5 offsuit, which is one of the very worst hands in poker. And it was hard for me to imagine that it could even be indifferent between calling and going all in, or sorry, between folding and going all in with that hand. I just couldn't imagine going all in being anything other than a very negative expected value play. So what did you guys find when you ran some analysis on that hand?
Right. So we did find that this was a lower probability hand, or action rather, that it would fold 98% of the time, and so it'll go all in here 1.3% of the time, and with smaller probabilities it will raise either half pot or pot. It actually almost never calls here, so it's actually interesting that all in isn't the least likely action for to take. It's actually the second most likely. It's still dwarfed by 98% for fold, of course. Yeah, as far as value, yeah, that we don't really know anything about. As far as, there are a number of other hands it'll do this with. Actually, the most likely hand that it will go all in with is ace-queen offsuit. Hmm. Yeah, and it does that with 90%.
Wow, so there actually are some hands where it... That's interesting.
Yeah. But yeah, it's essentially the ace-queen, ace-jack offsuit that it likes to jam there with. And so I guess doing it with a weaker hand, mixing in just a little bit, maybe is the right thing to do so that you don't always fold when it has these stronger hands.
So I would agree that there are some hands, like it would need to mix in a few hands, I think, besides just the ace-queen and the ace-jack. But I wonder, because this is something that we got, I spoke at some point with the creator of, or one of the creators of GTO Range Builder, which is one of the, like, you know, consumer-facing products that enables you to input a situation and it can output an equilibrium solution for that, you know, given a few constraints. And what he told me is that if you see a solution where the output strategy is, you know, do something 99% of the time and do something else 1% of the time, that's most likely a convergence issue. So essentially, like, if this were to continue running trials for, like, a much longer period of time, it would eventually arrive at never making that very small probability play, and that something like that would just be noise. Does that seem like a possible explanation for what we're seeing here?
Possible, but it's still tough to diagnose. I mean, so yeah, you're right. The way that these programs learn to play, like either DeepStack or GTO Range Builder or any of the old stuff, really, is essentially just by playing against itself, right? And so if you run it for 5 seconds, then it learns a strategy, and if you run it for 10, then it, you know, should come up with something a little bit better, and so on. So it could be that. It could be just that if we ran it, you know, for 10 seconds on the preflop instead of for 5, then it might have flushed that out of its range. Having the little 1%, though, we have found in the past, sometimes those tiny percentages are important. So this is one of the things that comes up in the computer poker competition every year. And when we do it there, we call it thresholding. So thresholding might mean take any action in the range that's under 1% and just set it to 0, and then kind of normalize all the other actions to bring them back up. So this is how you can flush out these little, you know, fractions of a percent that are sitting around. And we wrote a paper in 2011 where we looked at this, and we actually found that thresholding often hurts. So if you're thresholding at, like, a big number, like at 20%, you know, it's not hard to imagine why that would hurt, right? Like, maybe it's important that, you know, you have at least some time, but not very often. We found 1%, if we thresholded our strategies at 1%, it actually made them more exploitable rather than less. If we got really tiny, like 0.01%, then that's where it was giving some benefit. But those situations are also so rare that they couldn't even help exploitability very much. So I think to answer your root question, it's we don't know. it could be noise, and it could be we could flush it out, or it could be that it's important somehow. Although I do agree with that particular hand, that does not look like a very promising all-in. So if I had to bet, I'd bet if we ran it longer, we'd flush it out.
And this is significant, I think, for human players, and it goes to show the difficulty for human players of implementing equilibrium strategies, even once we see them, is that, you know, that these kind of percentages do matter. And so if you just look and say, because this is an error that I used to make when I would look at these solutions, and I would see, well, you know, it's betting 80% of the time and calling 20% of the time, so betting is a better play. Right. And, you know, again, it wouldn't be employing a mixed strategy unless it believed they had the same expected value at equilibrium. So it's not a matter of one being better than the other. It's a matter of if you don't ultimately take these actions at these frequencies, there will be some exploitability in your game. You know, whether or not the way your opponent's playing will actually take advantage of that exploitability will depend on sort of the skill of your opponent. Now, in the computer poker competitions, is it sort of the norm that everyone is trying to play an equilibrium strategy, or are there people there who are trying to employ exploitive play?
Yeah, there are people that try for exploitive play, but I think the trend really over the last decade, we started the computer poker competition in 2006, and since then, almost entirely, the most successful programs have been the ones that do equilibrium approximation, which is... I find is actually kind of disappointing, because, you know, the challenge of poker is about you know, discovering your opponent's mistakes and changing your play to maximize your winnings. I think the reason it's wound up that way is just that the algorithms that we use for finding equilibria are really powerful, and you don't need to know anything about your opponent to use them. And all the trickiness of the game, you know, discovering what someone's doing wrong inside of 100 hands is just really tough for programs. Mm. At least no one's had a compelling breakthrough there.
Well, and assuming that you're doing a decent job with the equilibrium algorithms, then there shouldn't be much reward for people trying to pursue an exploitive strategy anyway.
Exactly. Yeah, there's this feedback loop, right, where once half the people are doing equilibrium, then it means it's really risky for you to go off equilibrium, because there's no one else to beat up, and you're going to lose against the equilibrium bots. And so over time, yeah, when, you know, not just half, but 3/4 and 90% of the programs are making some attempt at equilibrium, there's really not much signal there to latch onto.
Yeah.
We've had lots of discussions about ways to try to fix this, like by seeding the competition with weak bots, for example, right, to give some target something there to go and exploit. Mm. But yeah, that never really paid off.
And that would make a nice corollary for real-world poker tournaments, where for the most part you won't see a tournament, or certainly, you know, a cash game or something. It's rare to see a game where there are nothing but good players playing against each other. There's really not a lot of incentive for talented players to do that. The times when you will see it might be because, you know, there was like added promotional money to encourage these players to have this game, or there's, you know, something on the line. Generally, like a high stakes game, even if it's mostly full of tough players, won't go unless there's one or two, you know, perceived weaker players in that game. So, I mean, it is sort of, I don't know to what extent you guys care about that, but it is actually kind of a better simulation of what any sort of real world high stakes poker situation would look like, is that there would be at least a few fish in there for all those sharks to be fighting over.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, we're getting pretty far with the equilibrium approximation, right? Like, DeepStack is really doing heads up no limit well. I think it can be that tough to scale it up to everything in 10 game mix, for example. So the only two directions to go after that are multi-way, which is a huge problem that we're really excited to work on, and opponent modeling, right? That's the challenge that's left.
In terms of the multi-way, and this is quite possibly just me misunderstanding a passage from Mathematics of Poker, which, by the way, is that a book that you guys would have had cause to read?
I think probably half the guys in our group have read it. I haven't.
Okay. No, I haven't.
So there's a section where, at least my understanding of the author's argument, even Nate is probably in a position to correct me on this, is that there may not be equilibrium. Essentially the Nash, what he proved is that there will be an equilibrium solution in a finite two-player game. But in a multiplayer game, I guess there will be equilibriums, but they won't necessarily be... they can have different expected values for each player, such that like one player might prefer one equilibrium and a different player would prefer a different equilibrium, such that there might not be an unexploitable strategy in the same way that there is in a heads-up game. Can you guys help me explain that better?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad you're asking the question, because this is one of the most frustrating things about reading online forums, like reading 2+2 sometimes or anywhere, is people just misunderstand what GTO means or misunderstand what equilibrium means. So I'll start just by talking about, you know, two-player zero-sum games, right? So heads-up poker, if you're playing without a rake, that's the one scenario where Nash equilibria have really nice properties. It means that if you can compute one, it's guaranteed to not lose against anyone, even if they know what you're doing. So that's the first useful property. And the second one is that all equilibria have the same value. So it doesn't matter which equilibrium you compute, if there's more than one, they'll all tie against each other. They all have the same guarantee about not losing. So that makes it really easy. It means you almost don't care what the opponent's doing. You can always force a tie. And you don't even have to go pick the right equilibrium. You just pick whichever one you get. If you're going to a multi-way game, even if you just have a three-player game, it doesn't have to be 6 or 10, even just at 3, all of the mathematical theory that we rely on falls apart a little bit. So Nash equilibria still exists. Like, that's Nash's famous proof he got the Nobel Prize for. all that proves is that there exists at least one strategy where no player has incentive to deviate unilaterally. Meaning, if you're the only one to change, there's nothing you can do to improve your payoff. The problem with multiplayer games is everyone else except for you are going to change, right? You can't just be thinking about you changing on your own. It's everyone else that's going to adapt to exploit you. So if you're in a multiplayer game, equilibria still exists, but there's two problems. The first is that we don't have any efficient algorithms for computing them, so you can't get one. And the second problem is, even if you did get one, it wouldn't be useful. It wouldn't have any of those guarantees about not losing. You wouldn't even be able to bound how much you could lose by. There can be different equilibria that give different payoffs, meaning if we're in the equilibrium where you and Nate and Dustin all gang up on me, I'm going to have a bad day. But if we're in the equilibrium where me and Dustin and Nate gang up on Andrew, then you're having a bad day. So that's a problem. What else? They're not interchangeable. This is even really bad, too. This means even if all four of us compute our own Nash equilibrium, and then we all come to the table to play, our own fractions of the different ones we compute, that combination itself might not be a Nash equilibrium. So really, all of these nice theoretical properties we rely on in two-player just aren't there. So equilibrium is, just a useful way forward.
I think another thing that tends to trip up poker players in these conversations is that the way that game theorists use the term collusion is not the way that poker players tend to use the term collusion. Like, that's a dirty word in the poker world. Collusion is cheating. Collusion is like, if Nate and I are playing against you and we're sharing our cards or we're somehow signaling to each other, right, that's collusion. But strategically, there can be just sort of, you know, soft collusion where if Nate and I are much better players than Michael, it could be in both Nate and my interest not to contest pots with each other. And that's not anything that we would have to break the rules of poker to establish. We wouldn't have to discuss with that with each other. We could just sort of each independently pursuing our own self-interest arrive at this equilibrium strategy that involves both of us beating up on you. And my understanding is that that would sort of meet a game theoretical definition of collusion, but would not be, you know, violating the rules of poker in the way that we tend to use the word collusion in our little circle, in our jargon.
Exactly, yeah. We've written a paper on collusion and detecting collusion. When we did that, we thought about, you know, several different levels, right? It could be the full-on, you know, we're sharing our cards through private chat and exchanging money after the game. It could be exchanging money after the game, except without sharing any knowledge during the game. Or it could be, like you said, just this very incidental collusion where, for good strategic reasons, maybe you and I want to gang up on Dustin and kick him out of the game and then battle it out ourselves. And that's just maybe a good tournament to play. We have one really neat example about this. Okay, so I mentioned earlier that in multiplayer games, you can't compute equilibria efficiently. Like, we don't have a good algorithm for going and computing one. There is one game that we wrote a paper on where we can. So there's a game that we made up called Three-Player Leduc Hold'em. This is a three-player game with a four-card deck. Three-player Coon Hold'em.
Yeah,
so a four-card deck, everyone gets dealt one card, and there's enough money for one bet and one call, and that's it. With this game, if we run our algorithm that we use for solving games on it, it's not guaranteed to get an equilibrium, but in this game it actually does, and we can prove that it does get an equilibrium. Now, like I mentioned, it still doesn't have any of the useful guarantees about not losing. And in fact, what it finds is a whole family of equilibrium. So there's a whole range of ways to play that are all kind of balanced against each other. And the thing that's really kind of horrible about this game is that player two in this game has all the power, because they get to decide whether player one wins or player three wins. If they're using any of those equilibrium strategies, there's nothing they can do to affect their own payoff, or at least to increase it. But they can shift the game so that either player one or player three wins more than they otherwise would. And player one and three are just stuck, right? They have to hope that player two likes them, and that's it. So this is just a little example of what happens in poker games. Like, there's all these kingmaker mechanics where if you're thinking about equilibrium, it could be out of your control.
And my understanding, because we've had a game designer on the show before, is that for people who are designing multiplayer, like board games or card games or something, this is a real concern also, because those, like when there is a strong kingmaker dynamic like that, it tends not to be very fun, because the outcome of the game is often determined by some sort of like social relationship that is sort of is exterior to the game itself. Player two's choice is relatively arbitrary strategically. Like, his expected value isn't changed based on which of those other two players wins. And so, it kind of becomes a popularity contest between player one and player three. And so I think, like, for even for, people who are designing recreational games, that that kingmaker dynamic is something they have to be, conscious of finding a way of getting around that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And actually, it can come up in some other, there's a clear poker context where it comes up sometimes. Are you guys familiar with the concept of satellite tournaments?
Yeah, trying to win at tourneys to get into a bigger tournament.
Exactly, and many of these, it'll be the case that multiple players will win the same prize. So like a traditional poker tournament is sort of like a tiered, first place gets 25% of the prize pool, and second place gets 15%, and third place gets 10%. And so it's, it's tiered like that, and there's some incentive to keep eliminating players and accumulating chips, even when there's only four and three and two players remaining. But in satellites, there's a flat payout structure at the top. So it might be that 10 players are going to win a seat to the higher tournament. And so player one wins the same prize as the player who finishes in 10th place. And it can be the case that one player has accumulated so many chips that he's essentially guaranteed a spot. Maybe there's 11 players left and their 10 spots are going to pay out. And player one has so many chips that like almost nothing he could do would cause him to not win a seat at this point. And so now he can essentially just decide which player he's going to go after. And the other players are still going to have to be taking risks to try to, not be the last player eliminated, and he can choose, whether he folds or calls their bets. Makes no difference to him. His expected value is still going to be equal to the price of the seat, and so he can essentially just decide, of these 11 players or of other 10 players remaining, which one do I want to try to eliminate and which ones do I want to help out. And that's a real problem that we run into in satellite tournaments. Because often what will happen is, there'll be like a satellite for a big tournament that's running at, let's say, Falls View, since y'all are Canadian, at the Falls View Casino. And so a bunch of players from America maybe will come and they'll play against, in a satellite like that, with a bunch of regulars at Falls View, people who play together frequently at Falls View. And there might be no explicit collusion going on here. Like, there may not be a conversation between Falls View regular number one and Falls View regular number two saying, hey, let's help each other out. But they're friends. They play together all the time and they talk to each other and they eat dinner together. And then, these Americans show up at their tournament, and they're foreigners who have come here just to make money from the Falls View Casino. And so when we're all playing in a satellite tournament together, and this is not, I've only chosen Falls View because you all are Canadian, not because I have any particular reason to believe there's collusion going on at Falls View. But there may end up being that kind of kingmaker dynamic, and I tend to avoid those satellites for that reason.
Yeah, it makes sense. Even just think about a different scenario. Thinking about like programs play against people, I'll bet if we were playing six max, and if you had five humans and one AI at the table, and even if the humans weren't colluding, and even if they couldn't tell whether the other players were humans or the AI, I would guess that the AI wins less than 1/6 of those, those matches, right? Just from, being kind of the odd one in to a team of, or to a group of people used to each other's style of play. Mm-hmm. And similarly, I'll bet if you do five AIs and one human, and the AIs aren't colluding, I'd still put that human's odds at less than 1/6.
Yeah, that seems right.
Which kind of leads into what is going to be the challenge for playing against humans, like in multiway, is how to set up the match to try to, reduce that effect, or even just to stop the humans from, from intentionally or unintentionally colluding against the AI. I think that's one of the biggest things holding us back from pursuing it, is we just don't know how to set it up in a way that everyone would agree with is fair.
Right. Well, I wanted to ask Nate a question about, Nate, your experience playing against DeepStack on the stream. I was kind of surprised by the extent to which I started to feel frustration playing against it. You know, not in the sense, you know, in the same way that like sometimes human opponents will, you know, get under your skin by being annoying or whatever. You know, it was nothing to do with DeepStack's, you know, behavior, and the Michaels and everyone on the stream were perfect gentlemen. So it was nothing to do with any of that. But you know, just sort of feeling like, how can I, like, I can't even make good decisions against this thing, or I don't know. Did you experience any of that?
I certainly felt disoriented. A lot of what a lot of what I felt is the recognition, the searing recognition that so much of my play is just this live pro fish thing, where before I can even get to square one, I'm making all these exploitive assumptions off the bat. Mm-hmm. Even pre-flop strategy, but certainly later in the hand, where I'm asking, what should I do on this turn? And, you know, I'd like to think I have a good theoretical foundation in the game, and compared to a lot of players, I do. But all these questions I'm habitually asking myself, like, oh, do I think this person will overraise or underraise the turn? What is this person's preflop range looking like? So, you know, in interaction with the board texture, all my usual conscious or subconscious or highly abbreviated, because I have to do it under time pressure, all my ways of talking to myself about this are just either short-circuited or rendered irrelevant by the fact that I'm playing against a computer who is not adjusting to me, who is highly balanced, who doesn't, you know, fear losing irrationally much, who doesn't say, oh, this pot's big enough for me, I go all in, who doesn't do any of these things. And my heuristics just don't make any sense. You know, it makes me wonder what driving a or riding in a self-driving car might be like, or all these other situations where I might have to start acting interacting with artificial intelligences, what that'll be like. And I think a commonplace in poker writing and in the way that good poker players talk about poker is, you know, on level one, I have a theoretical foundation. Then later, I deviate from that foundation if I notice something exploitable about my opponent. And indeed, I think at least sometimes that I play like this, or that that's at least a useful way to think about how I play. And now I'm starting to question all that. I don't think that's how I play. I think I have this complicated tangle of heuristics and what I think I know about unexploitable play. And what I think I know about how to exploit opponents, those sort of get tangled together all the way down. And it's not the case that I can jettison off the exploitive part of my game as a sort of appendage. I don't think I can do that. So it's disorienting, and I think it's raised difficult metaphysical questions about the whole way I play poker.
Yeah, you guys have caused Nate to have a nervous breakdown.
I'm always like this, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I think to some extent that question that you phrased at the beginning of, you know, what should I do in this turn situation? You know, sometimes the answer to that question is arrive here with a different distribution of hands, which is like, it's an unfortunate conclusion to come to once you're already there.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, I had a similar experience where there were some cases where I felt like I was reasonably capable at least of getting the low-hanging fruit. So you remember before I was saying kind of recognizing like what are the hands that strictly prefer betting or strictly prefer checking. I guess I really have no way of like proving this. I am tempted to say that I'm reasonably capable of recognizing in a common situations like whether or not to continuation bet a flop, to bet a second time on the turn. I think some of those things I'm reasonably good at recognizing, like what are going to be the 100% bets and the 100% checks. But anytime that you start to face a slightly trickier line, even, you know, just a slightly more unconventional line than I myself am taking. So when I check the flop and then have a decision about whether to bet a particular turn card and how much to bet, I often felt very kind of disoriented in those situations. And I'm trying to think, well, you know, where am I now in my distribution of hands? How much information am I giving away by having checked the flop? And even though, you know, DeepStack is not exactly taking advantage of that information, I think that's still sort of a relevant question strategically. Like, if there are hands that I would strictly prefer to bet the flop with and, you know, not betting the flop, I've essentially, like, you know, in a strategic way, given away the information that I don't have those kinds of hands. And I think that DeepStack's play on the turn will sort of reflect that I am not incentivized to get to the turn with those sorts of hands. So I think, like, trying to sort through those questions I found very difficult. And then when you combine that with some of the variants of, like, it's not even necessarily that I made bad bluffs, you know, or call downs or whatever, but then, you know, when they don't work out and you weren't confident of them in the first place, then it sort of, you know, rattles your confidence in terms of your ability to sort through those situations going forwards. Was that entertaining for you guys to watch? I don't know. Did you feel some smug triumphalism seeing us melt down a little bit?
Well, I mean, it's certainly nice to know that the DeepStack can get to you know, strong players like yourselves. I think that speaks to like how balanced it is and. You know, how good a job it's doing at trying to approximate equilibrium. Definitely, you know, whenever you're having trouble, you know, making decisions or thinking about, if you're unsure about what DeepStack's range is in different positions, then that's, you know, we think that's great.
I guess, you know, I'm just sort of recognizing that there is a war coming between the humans and the artificial intelligence, and I'm trying to suss out which side you guys are going to be on. Did you feel any sympathy for your human brothers, or was it just, go forth, my pretties, and kill?
No, team humanity for sure.
I think there's a symbiotic relationship here. Like, we can learn a lot from these techniques. You know, we can learn a lot about, you know, how to play these games really well and in a different way than we're usually accustomed to thinking about them. Like, as Nate said, it's often hard to disconnect the kind of strong foundational play, you know, against anyone, and separating that from your exploitive play, because, you know, we're usually playing against humans, and so, you know, oftentimes we just try to exploit them, you know, as much as we can. But these techniques they're totally in the opposite direction, where they don't care about, you know, the particular person they're playing against. They don't try to exploit. They're just trying to play really strong, you know, fundamental poker. And I think that's a useful thing to study. And it's, you know, makes people better, you know, because we have these tools.
I'll jump on that quickly too. Yeah, that I think, you know, having developed these programs, it's really neat now to use them for sparring partners for people, or, you know, training, like, to look at what does the bot do and how should that affect what you do when you play against other people. This is one of my favorite things that came out of Cepheus for Heads Up Limit when we solved it 2 years ago. Is now, because it's on the web page, you can go play against it, or you can go look up what it does in any spot. And one of my favorite types of threads to find on 2+2 is to find people discussing Heads Up Limit and looking up moves that they've been typed into the interface to find out what Cepheus would have done in their spot, and then the long discussions about what that means, and actually trying to understand what its strategy is doing, as opposed to just the raw numbers. Mm-hmm. So it's really neat now to have actual answers they can go look up for things that might have been open questions for years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's nice to see that doesn't shut, because you might think, like, that just kind of closes the discussion. Like, there used to be conversations on 2+2 about what should you do here, and then, you know, you might think that just being able to sort of look in the back of the book and find the answer would shut down the discussion. But as you said, I mean, it's not like you can look up every single, I mean, even though in theory you could, like, practically you can't look up every possible situation. So still, you know, human players are very interested in kind of how do we, it's a whole new conversation to have now in terms of how do we interpret these solutions and how do we learn from them in order to, you know, make our play better in ways that we can actually execute on.
Yeah, trying to discover the rules of thumb, right, that actually tell you how to guide your play when you go play for real, and you don't have that that interface their way to tell you what to do.
Right, and I tried to sort of talk through in the match while I was playing, talk through my thought processes and like what were the rules of thumb that I was using, knowing that I wasn't going to be. And again, I did find myself often in the situation that Nate described of feeling like many of my heuristics, or just recognizing that they actually were founded more on experience of playing against humans than on a theoretical parsing of the game. But it was much as possible trying to talk through, why am I choosing this exact hand to bluff with or to call down with? Like, what are the heuristics at least that I'm currently using? And I mean, those are informed by a very modest amount of study with other equilibrium solution generators. Do you guys have any plans to make this or a related no limit AI, something that the general public can play with or against?
It's a good question. We've talked about it a bit internally. I think the most immediate holdup for us right now is because the bot runs just using a single GPU, right? So like a graphics card you use for video games. It ties up a bit of hardware whenever we have someone playing. And so for the Twitch matches right now, we have four machines with video cards, which means we can have two people practicing and two people actually playing. So that's kind of the most immediate reason why we haven't opened up a web interface for just anyone to play against it. I think for me personally, I think I would love to see it, both to let people play, but also, to be able to look at the data and find out what type of strategy people are using.
Yeah,
so it's definitely something we're talking about and thinking about doing.
One other quick thing about that is, we have to be careful too that we don't make it easy for people to essentially redirect DeepStack's play, to online games, and so we're very cognizant of that, and we want to avoid any kind of risk of DeepStack playing online.
There is that. So for Cepheus, we had the page where anyone could go look up its strategy. Mm-hmm. And we didn't mind doing that because Heads Up Limit was essentially dead online. That's an aspect we would not do for Heads Up No Limit, because people still... Mm-hmm.
For now. Is DeepStack, are you looking at that as still a work in progress, or do you feel like you've gotten as far as you're going to get, or as you care to get, on the problem of Heads Up No Limit, and you really are just looking towards, as we were saying, either the multiplayer games or other variants of poker?
Yeah, it's actually really exciting. So we had a good 10-year run from about 2007 to 2017, just before DeepStack. So in 2007, we developed a new algorithm called CFR, and that's kind of the algorithm behind, as far as we're aware, almost all of like the really competitive programs in the computer poker competition. And it had a certain set of trade-offs. Like, it was all, it required a lot of memory to run, it required a lot of computation to run, because you had to kind of train the strategy from scratch ahead of time before you played your very first hand. And the algorithm behind DeepStack is entirely different. Now it doesn't use much RAM, it doesn't do a ton of computation ahead of time. It just runs right on the GPU, and it kind of plays in real time. Like, as you're playing against it, it's figuring out what to do in that spot. So it's kind of like high-powered sub-game solving. You mentioned GTO Range Builder or PyoSolver, some of those. This is like a version of that that has theoretical guarantees that it'll go to Nash, and you can use it anywhere in the game, even pre-flop. So I think even for No Limit, this is the first one that worked. Like, we're at version one of this new algorithm now, and there's going to be a ton of progress to make. So I think that's really exciting. I think we'll be able to get it way stronger, even in Heads Up No Limit. Mm-hmm. But other than that, yeah, going to mixed games is really exciting. I think the algorithm will just scale very naturally to those. Going to multiplayer is kind of the real prize. Because, Heads Up is a very specialized game. If we could do 6-player or 10-player, and if we managed to beat humans at that, then I think we could claim that we've conquered the game. Mm. Until then, if it's just Heads Up, then we can't make that claim at all.
I mean, are you guys just sort of interested in being able to say you can beat humans, or you sort of like conquered the game of poker? I guess kind of like what's in it for you to check that box?
Yeah. Our real motivation for all of this isn't poker. I mean, very, very few of us in the group are actual poker players. So if Mike Bowling was on the show, he would tell you that it's, you know, that we're studying games with imperfect information, or really decision making with imperfect information, because imperfect information happens all the time in the world. You know, every time we get in the car and drive to the store, we don't know where what's around us is going. We don't know what their goals or motivations are. We don't know if, you know, randomly there's going to be a car accident ahead of us or catch the lights just wrong. So that's really the motivation behind all of our research, is just learning good scalable techniques to deal with other opponents or other players and deal with information we don't know. At the same time, at least for me personally, there is a bit of allure to, right? Like if you ask someone about famous computer programs or famous computer programmers, nothing has really risen to the level of like Einstein. But if you ask for famous programs, you know, lots of people know about Deep Blue, mm-hmm. right? The first program to beat checkers, chess. Lots of people know about AlphaGo, which Google DeepMind's program that beat Go last year. 2 years ago now, 2015?
AlphaGo was, no, it was last year, 2016.
Yeah, last year. Yeah, and so there is a challenge to, you know, finding the world's best players at a game and trying to surpass them. So yeah, there's definitely some glory involved there too. And I can't lie and say that doesn't appeal.
And I know, you know, poker represented a sort of unique twist relative to checkers, chess, Go, in the sense of having hidden information, right? That's not a feature of any of those other games. I mean, does that make No Limit Hold'em kind of the apex of two-player games, or are there other games that humans play that would be even more of a prize to conquer than No Limit? Heads up.
Oh, I think there's definitely other games that would be even bigger prizes. Mm-hmm. For me, I think poker is kind of the next obvious one. It's probably the most popular game that really expresses imperfect information as being, like, that is the core of the challenge. Mm-hmm. To give you an example of a different one, in fact, a different one that AI is working on right now, it's StarCraft. Right, so a computer game, real-time strategy. There is a huge research effort underway, and has been for a decade. We went to grad school with a guy, Dave Churchill, who worked on this for his whole PhD. Google is working on this. I heard Facebook is working on this. Like, StarCraft is a game that also embodies, you know, imperfect information, because you don't know what your opponent's doing, what kind of army they're building. In terms of the size of the game, StarCraft is far, far, far larger than poker. Like, it's almost continuous in, like, every dimension, both in time but also in, you know, dimensions of space, like where units are and what they're attacking and what they're all doing. So I think for that, seeing a program that could beat humans at that game would be a more complicated challenge. I think it's also tougher for humans to play. I don't think there's any sense that humans are anywhere close to optimal in StarCraft. And I would guess, if we could measure that, I would guess that they're closer in poker. Because poker is a simpler game both for humans and for computers.
Mm. I'm trying to think about other kind of variables that would make a game different. One that's coming to mind is like a Hearthstone or Magic the Gathering, a game where constructing your deck or the tools that you're going to use in the game is itself a strategic element of the game. Are you aware of any AI work going on along that dimension?
I've read a little bit about people looking at Magic. Magic would be really cool. For exactly the reason you mentioned, right? There's this whole metagame up front of, you know, planning ahead and what types of decks are you going to face, mm-hmm. and, you know, having counters to, things you think people might do. Mm-hmm. That'd be really cool. Just to mention another one, another classic game is Bridge. So now you have a cooperative game where you have to reason about what your teammate's doing, and you need to in Bridge, not just with a strategy for how to play the game, but also a strategy for how to bid. And humans have kind of arrived at like these bidding conventions for, you know, how to place bids in order to communicate. And that would be a really juicy problem to work on too from an AI perspective.
Do you have any plans to do that? We have, by the way, a listener who has written to me begging me to ask you, not begging me, politely requesting that I ask you if you have any plans to get into Bridge.
Yeah. So Michael Bowling had a student about 2008, I think, who was working on Bridge. And it turns out that Bridge is brutally hard. It has all the things that make poker hard, like that you have, you know, a deck of cards, there's hidden information. Except in Bridge, you're looking at 13 of them instead of at 2. And you have a teammate that's also looking at 13. And just the space of possibilities for how you might bid is massive. So at the time, that project didn't get a whole lot of traction just because the problem was far too hard. I'd be really curious to know now, using some of the modern algorithms that we've come up with, if we might be ready to take another shot at that.
Did you guys have any other reactions arising from the match, or things that came up in the match that you wanted to debrief about?
Yeah, nothing comes to mind. We had the list of hands that were kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. Both the queen hand that we talked about and the odd all-in with mm-hmm. the 8-5 off. Mm-hmm. Still to do, we have our variance reduction technique that we're still working on. We actually did use that in the paper that we wrote for Deep Stack. So it works in a fixed blind game if we're playing 200 deep. We have a couple more changes yet to make it work on the freeouts. But as soon as that's done, that's going to be really exciting.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to seeing that.
Yeah, and subtract out luck. So.
And yeah. By the time this airs, you'll have already played your match against Terrence Chan and Adam Schwartz from the 2+2 poker cast. I guess there's not really anything you guys need to do to prepare for that, right? I mean, the program is what it is. You're not like gearing up for it or anything, I suppose.
I think we're ready, but we do know that those guys are definitely preparing. So Adam has now played, I think on like Monday alone, he played 11 freezeouts.
Wow.
So he's doing a ton. Terrence is practicing as well.
Yeah.
We have a Dutch Boyd coming up the week after that, too.
An interesting choice.
I was not expecting that name.
No, it'll be fun. It has a bracelet, right? Already is just, used to streaming. So we're going to play just one-on-one against him for a best of five, I think. But that's going to be exciting.
All right. Well, best of luck.
Yeah, thank you.
So we'll be happy to talk to you guys again at some point when we have the variance reduction tool, if you guys want to, or if any of you is up for, talking to us about that, and any other ways that we can help out along the way. I think Nate and I are both really fascinated by this, and can't wait to see what you guys come up with next.
It sounds great.
Yep.
Thanks once again for coming on the show. It's been awesome as usual. Our listeners love you. We think you're great, and hope to stay in touch.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Thanks for playing the match with us last week, and thanks for this. Like I mentioned at the start, like there's nobody we would have rather picked to go first against Deep Stack.
Certainly our pleasure.
Very kind of you.
Have a good night.
Have a good night.
Thanks, you too. I know you